But there, said Lucek, and strode away into the crowds.
What do you think? Kiss asked.
I think he's rotten to the core, Balak replied. But he's all we've got. We have to run with this.
Patience Kiss sighed.
Like we had to run with Stein, of Stein and Stein. I know. I still wish I could have killed the obsequious bastard, though.
Stein, of Stein and Stein, walked slowly back into the hall's main chamber of display and sat down heavily in the chair behind the simple wooden desk.
You did good, said the red-haired man, emerging from the shadows.
That's all very well, Stein grumbled.
Here's your reward, the red-haired man said.
A man, much larger than the red-haired man, plodded out of the shadows. He was wearing heavy power armor, but he made very little sound. He handed a weapon to the red-haired man. The red-haired man activated the blade. It made a shrill, grating whine.
Chainsword, said the red-haired man, lightly.
He raised the whirring weapon and swung it at Stein. Stein was too astonished to attempt any evasion. The chainsword struck him on the left arm, just below the shoulder, and carried on through, slicing him laterally across the upper chest. Stein's head and shoulders, like a statuary bust, flopped backwards over the chair back, and his arms, severed at the top of the biceps, dropped leadenly onto the ground. The top half of the chair's backrest, severed along with the upper part of Factor Stein, hit the floor too. Upholstery padding fluffed into the air like thistledown. Pressurized arterial blood squirted from the Factor's atomically cross-sectioned body in shuddering jets and spattered noisily across the top of the wooden desk. The red-haired man stepped back sharply in order to avoid getting splashed. He deactivated the chainsword and handed it back to the larger, armored man beside him.
No one leaves Stein and Stein alive, he said. Make sure of it.
No one.
End of story.
No problem, said the armored man.
He reactivated the chainsword so it was buzzing in his fist and clicked his link as he walked away across the chamber.
All teams, attention. Deploy and execute everyone in the building.
Chapter 7. The underboat Nail had leased left Pen 61 3 hours later. It was a chisel-nosed grey tube of steel and ceramite, 24 meters long, with a quiet cavitation drive along the center line and two heavy-bladed propulsion fans fixed ventrally in cage nacelles. It descended into the oily murk of the pen, lit up stab lights on its prow frame, and purred out through the pen mouth. The pen's sea doors opened into a long, square-cut channel of blue ice, and then out into the open water beyond the subframe of the giant hive. They passed gigantic foundation struts and derricks, brown with tar and mineral deposits, that jutted down through the ice pack and disappeared far below into the black deeps. A few bulk-capacity underboats went by along the same channel, inbound to the hive, laden with ore. Their stab-like rigs were lit up like the lures of abyssal fish. There were 9 people on board the craft. Ravener, Thonius, Balak, Kiss, Plyton, Nail, and the Carthaean, along with Lucek and the pilot servitor Nail had leased along with the boat.
Quite a crowd you travel with, Lucek commented to Kiss when he joined them at the pen key. Names don't matter, Kiss replied.
I wasn't asking for any, Lucek told her, though his gaze lingered on Ravener's support chair. Lucek had come dressed in dirty work clothes, a faded patched body glove, furs, and a quilted coat. He also carried a grubby shoulder pack.
Weapons?
Balak asked him.
Just tools of the trade, Lucek replied,
offering up the pack so Balak could wand it. Lucek chose to ride up front with Nail and the pilot. From the main passenger trunk, a spartan space with drop-down seats, they could see forward into the pilot house through the open hatch. Instrumentation glowed below the gloomy forward ports. Lucek was sensible enough not to attempt conversation with Nail. Once they had reached open water, Nail handed him the grey case containing the very expensive timepiece. Lucek looked inside briefly, put the case with his pack, and accessed the navigation punch box on the instrument panel. He entered a 19-digit code, the Q. Screens blinked and rolled as graphics redrew and remapped. Then a spidery red chart came up, with route and waymarker graphics overlaid in white.
That's some distance,
Nail said. 8 hours minimum, said Lusick, provided we don't encounter any hold-ups.
Hold-ups?
Nail asked. Ice falls, subcurrents. That's probably the worst we might get this season of the year.
There's worse.
There's maelstroms. Believe me, if there was any chance we'd run into one of those, we wouldn't have left the pen. Nail pointed to the nav display.
Is that the house?
Lusick shook his head. The house is currently sitting Neathside, about 40 kilometers south-southwest of that. The chart resolution's too large to show it. That's Berenth 88, one of the deep-water mining rigs, sitting in a 2-kilometer hole it's made for itself in the pack ice. That's our excuse for heading out that way. We'll divert when we reach 88. The others made themselves comfortable in the passenger trunk. Plighton leaned by one of the small armored port lights, craning her neck to see up and out. They were 300 meters down, and the water was black and clear like glass. But above them, it graduated into a green twilight.
Creepy, she murmured.
Angharad glanced at her.
All this water on top of us. The pressure. The cold.
Even if you could reach the surface, there is no surface. Just a roof of ice. Angharad shrugged and looked away. Little seemed to impress her.
The whole ocean's covered in pack ice, right? Plighton asked.
The whole thing, Ravenna replied, apart from a few anomalous breaks. In most places, the pack is 500 or 600 meters thick. Quite a roof.
Plighton grimaced. A fine time to discover I'm claustrophobic, she said.
You've traveled in the void, Angharad said. Compared to that, this is nothing.
It'll kill you just as fast, said Plighton. Besides, we can all have our own private fears, can't we?
I do not have private fears, said Angharad. That made Plighton laugh.
Any life out there? Plighton asked.
Algae, aggregated bacteria, phytoplankton. There may be no sunlight, but the moon's excessively active. A lot of thermal venting.
Anything bigger than that?
No. There are rumors, but no.
Cold,
said Plighton, glancing back out.
It's deep, too, Ravenna said.
The ocean floor depth varies, but in some places it's technically immeasurable.
Immeasurable? Asked Plighton.
Abyssal.
What do you mean, immeasurable?
I mean, it's so deep, any instrument sent down to sound it is crushed by the extremity of pressure.
What about Auspex?
Modar? That deep, that cold, that pressurized. The water starts to behave in very strange ways. It doesn't give up its secrets. You were right, Maud. In some ways it is much, much more dangerous than the void. The deep ocean of Utokri may be one of the strangest places in the Imperium, which is probably why the house is here.
Are you telling me this to reassure me? Plighton asked, slightly pale.
One can face one's private fears better if one understands their limits, I always think. I was giving you the best information I could.
That below us is a freaky abyss that we don't understand and could never escape from, Plighton asked.
Ravenna was silent for a moment. I probably shouldn't have opened my mouth, he said. He moved across the cabin to where Kiss was sitting.
Just so you know, we are out of contact. The Vox isn't making it through the water and the ice, not even via a relay at the Hive. Something, the ice, I think, but I don't know why, is bouncing psychic transmission. We can't talk to Kara.
You spoke to her before we left?
Just before. She knows what we're doing. I told her not to start fretting unless a week went by.
Ravenna saw that Kiss was still silently staring forward, keeping an eye on Lusick through the pilot house hatch.
Can we trust him?
No, she said. Not at all. He's in it for the money, I think. Besides, it's too late now.
And if he proves untrustworthy?
We're all armed. That kind of cancels everything out.
Lusick's estimate turns out to be conservative. It takes the best part of 11 hours just to reach the vicinity of the Berenth 88 deep-water rig. He blames contra-currents and an undertow effect called the Neath Stream, which cannot be predicted, strange on a moon where prediction is the most exclusive commodity. The journey becomes laborious. There's nothing but the sluggish purr of the cavitation system. The underboat's enviro systems are not the best, and it grows colder and the air stales. I sense the discomfort of the others, the body stink of anxiety and confinement. Maud is the worst. Her unexpected claustrophobia becomes physically oppressive to her. I do not wear Maud, nor would I attempt to without her consent, except in the most critical of situations, but I extend psi feelers gently into the periphery of her mindscape and work to reduce her clogging panic by influencing her respiratory rate and slowing her pulse. I adjust her metabolism into an instrument to fight her fears. Her mind, as I nestle against it, is in retreat, like a sick animal. I swim in her surface thoughts, her petty tensions and spectral fears. That's when I see the footprint. It's been carefully disguised, like a track in snow scuffed over to conceal it. It's been so carefully disguised, I cannot be sure it's what I think it is without a more invasive probe. And this isn't the time or the place for that. But I know what I think it is. I know what my years of experience scream to me it is. Sometime in the last 2 or 3 days, another mind has been in her. Another presence has taken a much firmer hold of Maud Plighton than I am doing with my light sigh caresses. She has been, briefly, under considerable mental duress. From who? And how? I haven't read another psyker, and she's hardly been out of my company. Kiss couldn't do this, and why would she? Now I feel a creeping dread upon me. What have I missed? What's been amongst my people without my permission, or even my knowledge? Lusik wears a blocker. Is there more to that casual insurance? Is he blocking the outside, or is he hiding something? Or is it? I try to reassure myself. The footprint could be false, a side effect of Maud's troubled state that I am misreading. Then again, her troubled state, her sudden claustrophobia, could have been triggered by aggressive manipulation. I broaden my mind for a moment and cast around. I feel the other heartbeats and minds around me, together with the hard negative of Lusik. Everyone's on edge, except Angharad, who is still and cold and silent like a pool. Nail is restless. Balak and Karl are both closed off and busy with thoughts of their own. Kiss feels me stir and looks up, a question on her face. It's nothing, Patience. Relax. It's not nothing. What has done this? I reach outside the underboat, but the sea is too cold and too blank for me to extend far.
88,
Lusik announced. The sound of the underboat's drive systems altered slightly as the pilot brought the craft around and slowed it. The sea ahead was lighter, more radiant. Nail studied the console displays and saw the vast hole, an artificial polynya, in the roof of ice above. Berinth 88 was a filthy, gargantuan engine sticking up out of the hole like a dagger in a wound. The lower limbs of the mining rig, its huge drilling members, extended down into the lightless depths below, churning up cloud banks of heated silt.
Voxlink's alive, Nail said.
The rig will have a fleet of boats down on operation, guiding the drilling, Lusik replied.
Lots of backwash litter, too,
Nail added, adjusting the listening scopes and the detectors to wash out the noise and minimize interference.
The rig's drill engines, circulator pumps, and hydraulics, Lusik replied, not to mention signals chopped and bounced by rising silt, and the suck rattle of the excavation tubes, and the low-level vibration of the icebreaker systems keeping the hole open. The sea's a funny place. Neath side, you have to get used to a lot of data clutter, and learn not to trust the sensors all the time.
He made a course adjustment with the pilot servitor's approval. The underboat nosed slowly around and slugged away on a fresh track, skirting the industrial site and its cloud of noise. They were running under the ice again in 5 minutes, heading south-southwest into clearer, colder water. The rig noise gradually receded behind them.
This water is colder, said Nail, reading off the instruments. 6 or 7 points, and falling.
That's because the seabed just dropped away under us, said Lusik.
He glanced at the pilot, who nodded confirmation.
We just went off over the Barents Shelf, 88 miles out about as far as there is ocean floor to reach. We just crossed from deep water to what we call holy water.
Holy water?
Holy, Lusik repeated with a lean grin. As in, there's holy nothing below us anymore. We're out over the abyssal zone. Nail woofed out a breath.
Don't tell Maud, he said.
Which one is Maud? Asked Lusik, looking back into the passenger trunk. Nail didn't tell him. Lusik grinned wider and shook his head. Deep ocean, my friend. We're in deep ocean now.
I'm not your friend,
Nail said sullenly. Lusik shrugged.
You might want to reconsider that. Out here, all alone, a man needs all the friends he can get.
Sholto? The little shipmaster didn't look up immediately. He was sitting at the master control of the Arethusa's bridge, with Fiflank and two of his most senior crewmen huddled around his shoulders. Kara approached. She'd slept, but not well. That surprised her, given that she was buoyant with relief. She'd had another dream, in which Carl had come to her in some wild desert place and done nothing but laugh. She'd asked him questions, asked him why he was acting so strangely, and he'd just laughed her. She'd woken in a cold sweat, sharply and suddenly, the headache pounding her temples. Belknap had been deep asleep in the bed beside her, his limbs twisted in the curious, boneless attitude of intense exhaustion slumber. She'd lain awake beside him for 5 minutes, and then jumped when the Vox intercom beeped. Leaping up gingerly, naked, she hit the stud before the second beep, hoping it wouldn't rouse Belknap.
Gotta, she had whispered.
Might it be permeable for you to come to the bridge with all effluviancy?
Problem?
A very curious necessity.
I'll be there in 5. She had dressed in silence. Belknap hadn't stirred.
Master Sholto, she said again.
Fiflank and the crewmates looked around at her and backed away to make space for her. She stepped in closer and crouched down beside the shipmaster's raised seat.
Mistress Kara,
Sholto said, glancing around with a thin smile. He looked awful, pale, jowly, drawn.
Sholto, are you all right?
He shook his head.
Forgive my unsanguine bearing. I fancy I took a little too much numbskull last night with your gentleman, the good doctor. He is a drinker of thirst, and I was thirsty, but not, in point to all goodly maid, a drinker.
You have a hangover? She smiled, relaxing slightly.
A terrible head, as you ask, all of throbbing and whimsy. Never again, as I have told myself before, and such dreams as I had. Quite a colostomy of nightmares.
Why did you send for me, Sholto? Is it Ravana? Has he signaled?
Unworth shook his head.
The grid has lit twice, with no preponderance from our friends below. They remonstrate themselves beyond our call. I sent for you because I was sent for in turn, so as it...
Sholto?
Kara said firmly. He nodded.
I will cut to the cheese. Master Borgwin was sitting night watch.
One of the crewmen behind her, a portly fellow from Ur Haven, with less than adequate hygiene or dental maintenance, nodded expressively.
Master Borgwin was on night watch, Unworth continued, here at this veritable station, and he detected a noise.
A noise?
A noise, in all certainty.
Kara frowned.
A noise? She repeated.
Unworth fiddled with the Vox dials.
I'm trying to locale it again.
What sort of noise? Kara asked.
Unworth shrugged.
Well, internal or external source?
To her dismay, Unworth shrugged again. Kara breathed carefully. Her head was killing her.
Sholto, I'm trying to be patient. What are you talking about?
There's something here,
Master Borgwin said. Fiflank growled in support. Get up, said Kara. She was in no mood for this. Unworth hopped down from the master's seat and let her take his place. He stood on the deck beside her. Kara settled down. She started to adjust the console controls. You're getting a Vox signal? Another ship? Or just back-chatter traffic from Utokri's Vox base? Sholto Unworth simply shrugged again. Kara gently turned the dials. A ghost frequency fluttered across the scope.
There,
Unworth said.
I saw it.
Hang on. She made some alterations. The signal wave became cleaner. Kara peered at it. That could be another vessel, pinging us with its primary auspex.
In all assurity, there is no other vessel in range.
I think you're right, said Kara. It's not external. This print is a signal coming from inside the ship. Let me just... She halted suddenly, froze.
What is it?
Unworth asked. She didn't dare tell him. She was looking at her hands as they worked the instruments. Her right hand. There was a ring on the middle finger of her right hand, a ring that didn't belong to her, and that she had no memory of putting on. In one awful sweeping moment, she was sure it was one of Carl's.
Shit!
She cried, pulling her hands back from the station as if stung. She tried to pull the ring off. It wouldn't budge. Unworth was still staring at the flickering signal, a yellow zigzag pulse that rippled like a cardiogram across the Vox screen. He leant in and made a final, tiny adjustment, locking the signal down. The noise came over the speakers. It made all of them shiver. It was the sound of a grown man sobbing. It went on and on, shuddering tinnily from the console speakers, sob after sob, a racking pain.
"What in hell's name is that?"
Kara whispered. She tried to sound defiant, but her words wilted as they came out. Her guts were like ice.
"Where's that coming from?"
"I know not," said Unworth, "except that I don't like it."
He reached one of his mutilated hands over towards the Vox system's main switch and threw it, shutting the system down. The screen went blank, and the chasing zigzag signal wave vanished. But the sound of the sobbing man kept coming from the speakers. Chapter 8
"You had better see this,"
Nail said. They were 13 hours into the trip. The pilot servitor was suddenly slowing the cavitation system and back-thrusting with the ventral fans. Kiss came forward into the pilot house and let Ravenna use her eyes.
"There's your witch house,"
Nail said. The underboat's rigged stab lights were illuminating something in the murk ahead, a structure suspended below the glowing roof of ice.
"Oh, God Emperor,"
Kiss muttered, craning forward between Nail and Lusik.
"Quite a thing, isn't it?"
the prospector said. The witch house was an armored metallic orb 300 meters in diameter. Neathside, everything was upside down. The orb was supported on 5 articulated mechanical legs, which gripped the canopy of ice above them. As they approached, the house scuttled back a few paces, its bladed claws scuffing the neathside of the ice cover. It was walking on the underside of the pack ice as if the pack ice was land.
"There's a legend on Loki,"
Nail began.
"The hut of a witch that runs through the forest on the legs of a game bird."
"Baba Yaga's hut,"
Kiss murmured.
"Baba Yaga's hut. Baba Yaga,"
Nail nodded.
"You've heard of it? It's not an old Loki legend. It's an old Earth legend." "That's so?"
asked Nail.
"That is so. Bring us in."
Nail glanced at the pilot.
"Bring us in."
Lusik shook his head.
"Wait, I need to broadcast the proper greetings. If we just close in, it'll run."
"Run?"
"I've seen it run. If it's scared or feels threatened, it can outrun this boat."
"Send the greeting."
"My boss says send the greetings, Lusik," Kiss relayed.
"He's a psyker, then?" Lusik asked. "I thought as much."
Kiss and Nail exchanged looks.
"At this stage," Nail said, "we really don't care what you think, Lusik. Send the greeting. Do what we paid you to do, or you'll be leaving this underboat through the wetlock with no breathing apparatus and a bullet up your ass."
"I don't answer for him," said Kiss quietly, "but he's more than capable of that, so don't piss him off."
Lusik pursed his lips and entered a contact code into the underboat's transponder. He checked it for fidelity once and then pressed broadcast. They heard and felt the pulse of the system through the hull. They waited.
"Does it usually take this long?" asked Kiss.
Lusik tapped a long, scrawny finger against his bony chin.
"No. The house is worried. Nervous. Probably because we're bringing a psyker aboard."
"It can sense that?"
Nail wondered.
He saw the look on Lusik's face and shrugged.
Of course it can.
Kiss leaned forward suddenly.
It's sending something. Throne. Missiles?
Nail leaned on the controls. Two darting shapes had burst from the witch house and were racing towards them, leaving bubble tracks in the semi-glazed water behind them.
Relax, said Lusik. Pilot fish.
The missiles slowed as they neared the underboat and turned, flashing and pulsing. The pilot servitor underwent some form of seizure and began to act mechanically. His mind and systems were locked to the navigation systems of the witch house. He steered them in, following the blinking pilot fish skimming just ahead of them. The bulk of the witch house loomed over the little underboat. They were being drawn up into a lighted cavity on the underside of the armored orb. The pilot fish zipped in ahead of them and vanished.
We're going in, said Nail.
Lock and load, Ravener ordered from the passenger trunk. Angharad rose and clutched her sheathed steel. Maud Plighton got up and racked her combat shotgun. Balak drew his las pistol and checked its heat. Carl rose to his feet and double-clicked the slide on his auto-pistol. Nail flipped his handgun out of its rig, banged back the slide, and put it away again. He glanced at Kiss.
You ready?
Kiss had slid out two kind blades, one in each hand. She nodded.
We're ready,
Nail announced. The underboat slowly entered the house's docking pool. Huge hydraulic clamps had once lifted underboats in and out of the docking pool and secured them to the wharf, but rust and neglect had long since rendered them useless. They protruded like the rotting claws of behemoth crabs from the gantry, trailing streamers of calcite and algae into the soupy dock basin. As the underboat surfaced, its fans blowing and sputtering the grease ice coating the pool's surface, Lusik opened the upper hatch and climbed out to make them steady, using dirty old chains and hooks that dangled from the gantry piers. The docking pool was dim, illuminated only by the underboat's light rig and a few faded lumen strips high up in the arched roof. The skeletal bulk of the gantry wharf and the perished docking clamps made distressing silhouettes above them, and the light cast wan, foggy reflections off the slowly wallowing, viscous surface of the pool. A pair of corroded metal ladders allowed them to clamber up onto the wharf platform. Nail opened the larger side hatch so that Ravener could move out and rise to the walkway.
Bad air, muttered Carl.
The house's atmosphere held the sickly tang of an air supply recirculated and poorly scrubbed too many times, like a starship that had been sealed in transit for too long. There was no sound, except for the slap of the grease ice, the dying thump of the underboat's fans, and the brittle clump of their footsteps. Nail, Lusik, and Plighton switched on lamp packs.
Cold,
Plighton shivered, buttoning her coat. Her mood seemed to have lifted, however, now she was out of the underboat's drab metal confines.
This way, said Lusik, and set off down the walkway. Why don't they keep this place in good order?
Carl wondered aloud.
It's not a way station or a depot, Lusik replied,
gesturing with one gangly arm.
The residents of the house expect those who come here to be perfectly capable of leaving again without supply or repair.
Residents, Ravener asked. How many? Lusik shrugged.
They don't tell me things like that.
Come on. Balak and Nail pushed past him to lead the way. The metal surfaces of the decks, walls, and machinery around them were caked in rust, or limed with verdigris and blooms of algae. There was an open, unlit hatchway at the back of the wharf platform, a hatchway that had clearly been open for so long, corrosion would not allow it to be sealed again. The deck beneath them shuddered. All the loose chains and hanging filaments in the dock swayed and clanked. Every weapon in the party rose ready.
Don't panic, said Lusik. The house just took a step to steady itself. Get used to the sensation.
The hatch led through into a service tunnel, where the lights had long since burned dead or had been robbed out for spares. Their weaving lamp beams caught strange surface mottling on the walls, but it wasn't rust.
Look at this, said Carl, training his lamp.
The area of wall he was illuminating was entirely covered in a curious, tight patterning that appeared to have been etched. As he moved the beam around slowly, they could see that the pattern covered everything.
What is that?
Kiss asked, leaning close.
fingerprints, said Angharad. No, it can't.
Fingerprints, the Carthayan repeated. She's right, Ravana said. His transponder, a dry rattle in the darkness beside them. Human fingerprints. The prints were life-size, packed in so close to each other that barely a scrap of wall remained unmarked. They looked as if they had been left by thousands upon thousands of finger touches, but the touch of a fingertip does not excise its shape perfectly into bare metal in miniature bas-relief.
They must have been engraved, said Carl. But the workmanship is astonishing. Who has the time to engrave so many individual perfect marks?
This is the house, Lusik replied, in an annoyingly offhand way.
What's really astonishing, said Ravana, is that every single print is different.
A ripple of deep unease ran through them. For the first time, Ravana felt the inscrutable Angharad register a scintilla of fear. The service tunnel continued on for 30 meters and opened into a wide, drum-shaped chamber. This was also unlit. Their lamp beams revealed a rickety metal spiral staircase against one wall, leading up into the shadows to a roof hatch. The center of the chamber was occupied by a cargo hoist, a cage of machinery surrounding a low rectangular plinth crusted in filth and oil residue. Above it, in the ceiling, the dim space of a riser shaft yawned like a throat. The rest of the chamber was cluttered with metal litter and rusting machine junk. There were two other doors, both of them sealed forever by rust and decay. Like the service tunnel, every part of the chamber's walls was covered with fingerprints.
"Do we go up?"
asked Nail.
"We wait," said Lusik.
"For what?"
"Just wait. We can't rush them. This is their party now."
They waited in edgy silence. The house rocked gently again, as it took another adjusting step.
"This," said Plighton.
"Shh," said Nail. He was gazing up into the open darkness of the riser shaft above them. A light came on far above them. It was thin and washy, a dirty fuzz of yellow radiance that penetrated only very faintly to their level. There was a distant, muffled thump of heavy gear, then a grinding noise. The hoist was descending. It came down the shaft slowly, bringing the wash of light with it. The hoist was an open-sided rectangular platform that matched exactly the dimensions of the plinth at the foot of the shaft. It lowered into view and settled with a resounding metal clang. Half a dozen mismatched oil lamps and bottle tapers stood on the platform, higgledy-piggledy, shedding their dirty, smoky glow. A figure stood in their midst, short, slender, like a youth or a child. The figure was shrouded in a hooded, floor-length cloak, and no face could be detected under the cowl. Ravana hesitated from scanning. He did not want to provoke the residents of the house. The figure wore an old, large, rusty key on a ribbon around its neck. It looked like the sort of antique key that might have once opened the gatehouse of a pre-heresy bastion. The figure gazed at them.
"These people come seeking coherence," Lusik called out, taking a step forward.
There was a nervous tremor in his voice.
"I am their guide."
For a brief moment there was a murmur of voices in the air around them, an unintelligible flutter of whispering, hissing voices, overlapped and urgent. Then it died away. The figure raised its left hand and beckoned them onto the hoist platform with a single, slow gesture. As Ravana steered his chair onto the platform, he knew he'd just tasted the first undeniable trace of the witch house's psycraft. Chapter 9. The hoist carried them slowly up 80 meters of rusty riser shaft into a vast circular theater that was lit around its edges by thousands of candles and lamps. The floor was formed of metal grill plates and arranged on a split level, with a raised ring walkway around the outside of the chamber, divided by an iron handrail from a circular central floor space. There were several heavy-duty hatches at intervals around the chamber walls. The hoist platform brought them up on the edge of the inner floor space. Above them, at the limits of the candlelight, the theater chamber's domed roof was a mass of support girders and heavy black frames in shadow.
They looked around, assessing their circumstances. Their weapons were sheathed and holstered, so as not to cause problems, but they were ready. Angharad glanced at Nail and nodded across the chamber. On the far side from the hoist, the room's raised ring walkway had a broad set of 7 metal steps set into its lip, virtually identical to the set that rose from the center floor space to the ring walkway itself. This upper set interrupted the encircling handrail and jutted out into the chamber over the inner floor space, leading to nothing. They'd all seen it. Nail glanced up into the roof's shadows. Was there something concealed up there that required step access when it descended? The robed figure walked off the platform onto the lower level. They followed, halting as the figure stopped and turned to face them again.
Hell's teeth,
Nail growled. A dozen more hooded figures, identical to the first, were suddenly standing on the raised walkway above them, staring down. They'd heard no hatch open. There had been no flicker of the candles. Each of the newcomers had a key around its neck, but no 2 keys were identical.
"Someone say something," Plighton whispered. "The tension is killing me."
Another flutter of sighing, hissing voices breathed around them. Ravener tentatively reached out with his mind. The situation was precarious, but he dared not wait any longer. Immediately, he encountered a strong background aura of psychic activity. The place was alive with it, as if it saturated the walls and the deck. It was resonating in a slow, gentle pulse, like breathing, but it wasn't coming from the hooded figures. They were utterly blank and inert to his inspection. The aura was around them all, as if they stood within a vast, psi-active mind, or as if the ocean outside was alive.
"I have come seeking coherence," Ravener said.
Lusik made no objection. He stood back.
"I have come seeking coherence," Ravener repeated.
The figure that had brought them up on the hoist had walked slowly up the steps to join the others of its kind on the raised walkway.
"Do you have names?"
"Voices," Ravener asked.
"We have both,"
said one of the figures. Its speech was audible and precise, though little more than a murmur in volume. The voice seemed young, too, although it was impossible to tell whether it was male or female.
"Will you tell me your names?" Ravener asked.
"Will you tell us yours?"
"Is that essential for our transaction?"
"No,"
said another of the figures.
"Though to receive accurate coherence, you must be truly known. This is not our function. It is up to the house to know you."
"What is your function?"
"We are merely housekeepers."
"I see. And how will the house know me?"
"It is learning already. You may speed the process by explaining your incoherence."
Ravener swung his chair around and faced Plighton.
"Maud, sir, I'd like you to escort Mr. Lusik back down the hoist to our craft and watch over him there."
"Wait," Lusik began.
"Does our guide need to be here any longer?" Ravener asked the hooded figures.
"His function is complete."
"The housekeepers have spoken, Lusik," Ravener told the prospector. "I thank you for your services of guidance and introduction, but I don't want you around while this is happening. Remove yourself, stay with the underboat, and we can remain friends."
Lusik glanced around, agitated and clearly unhappy. He knew he wasn't in a situation where he could put up an effective argument or fight. He forced a beaming grin onto his slender face and bowed.
"Of course," he said. "I have no wish to fall out with you. Out here, a man needs all the friends he can get."
Plighton gestured with the muzzle of the shotgun slung over her shoulder.
"Let's go," she said.
"Watch him, Maud."
Plighton nodded. She was still not used to directly sent thoughts. She followed Lusik onto the hoist platform, pulled the lever, and then slowly dropped below the floor. Ravener turned back to face the housekeepers.
"Explain what I can do in more detail."
"Describe the parameters of your incoherence in plain terms,"
one of the housekeepers replied.
"Allow the house to know you."
"And how is coherence communicated?"
"The right key opens the right door,"
said a housekeeper. Ravener's companions exchanged troubled looks.
Ravener rolled his chair forward until he was directly beneath the watching housekeepers on the raised walkway. "I seek coherence," he announced, as if speaking not to them, but to the chamber as a whole. "My name is Gideon Ravener. There's no point hiding that. I am searching for someone, a great enemy of mine. There's no point hiding that fact either. He has eluded me for a long time and driven me into a state of near ruin in my efforts to find him. The stars are a vast place, and he could be anywhere. I decided it would be better to search for something or someone that could tell me where and how to find him than to spend lifetimes searching for him fruitlessly. The Witch House of Eutokri has a great and ancient reputation for prediction. It is said the house's accuracy in such matters is extraordinary. In my past life, I was an imperial inquisitor and a loyal servant of the Ordo's Helicon. To seek out the guidance and psycraft of a place such as this would have been deemed the act of a radical or a heretic. It would not have been remotely condoned by the men I called my masters. But I am rogue now, and desperate, and I am acting outside the scope, knowledge, and permission of the Holy Inquisition. I am no longer an inquisitor. Perhaps I am damned, but I'll surely be damned if I don't know." The whispering voices of the house billowed around them. They reminded Kiss uncomfortably of the rushing wings of the Sheen birds at Petropolis. She was fighting the desire to weep. Ravener's spoken admission, even if it had been uttered with unnecessary emphasis to convince the witch house, had been painful to hear. "I am no longer an inquisitor. Perhaps I am damned." Perhaps they were all damned. "The one I seek goes by the name of Zygmunt Moloch," Ravener said. The voices swirled, their whispers becoming more sibilant and sharp. They streamed around Ravener like an eddying wind, like the frail sighs of phantoms. Now they could all hear what the voices were saying.
"Moloch, Moloch, Moloch."
At the base of the riser shaft, down in the gloom, Plighton led Lusik off the platform. She turned, dragged back the lever, and allowed the empty platform to trundle back up the shaft.
"How do we get back up?" Lusik asked.
"Please, Throne, we don't have to," Plighton replied.
They both carried oil lamps taken from the platform. By the light of hers, Plighton indicated the spiral staircase.
"That's got to lead up somewhere," she said.
"If needs be, but they need the hoist more than we do.
Come on."
They walked back along the service tunnel towards the docking pool.
"So, you're a Mard," said Lusik lightly.
"Don't talk to me," she replied.
They stepped back out into the gloomy wharf area, amongst the hanging rusty chainwork and rotting machinery. The underboat sat quietly below them, moored against the wharf's fenders by the heavy sea chains Lusik had fixed. The underboat's top and side hatches were still open, and pale electric light shone out.
"Checking in," Plighton said into her link.
The pilot servitor's voice crackled back an acknowledgement.
"Well, we could be in for a long wait,"
Lusik said, sitting down on the pier's edge so his feet dangled over the drop into the pool. He set the lamp down beside him.
"How will we pass the time if not in friendly conversation, Maud?"
"Don't talk to me," she replied.
Chapter 10
"I have a theory," Carl said.
"About?" Ravener asked.
"About how this place might work," Carl said.
They were still waiting down on the theater's lower space. The housekeepers had not moved or spoken, not even when the empty hoist returned. The flutter of whispers came and went like a breeze.
"Go on," Ravener prompted. "I don't think it's the house itself. There might be some active material or device here that acts as a focus, but I think what really matters is where the house is."
"Interesting. Go on."
"I think it's the ocean. I think it's the ocean itself. Somehow that responds and resonates to..."
He faltered.
"Actually, my theory is rather weak and open-ended."
I think you're halfway there, said Ravenna. That's good reasoning, but you're not taking it far enough. I agree the ocean is part of it, functioning as a resonating medium, but I think the real secret is the moon itself.
Eutocry?
Yes. How often do we find crystals or crystalline materials employed in divination and prediction? Sensing crystals, scrying crystals, crystals used to refract and focus psi impulses.
Crystal balls?
Exactly. The technique and belief is as old as man, and we are not the only species to appreciate the method.
The Eldar?
Precisely. The Eldar. Mineral resonance. Let's face it, it wouldn't be widely incorrect to define Wraithbone as an organic gemstone. This moon is infamously rich in a myriad different forms of crystal deposit. The Witch House
uses Eutocry as a gigantic crystal ball,
Carl said with a grin.
Am I close?
I don't know. If you are, it's a crude analogy, but those are the lines I was thinking along. Carl looked pleased with himself. You were almost there ahead of me that time, interrogator. I soon won't be able to teach you anything.
The stuff I know, Carl chuckled.
The fluttering whispers suddenly stopped. The abrupt silence was a little unnerving. With a shudder, the witch house adjusted its footing.
The house is ready, said one of the hooded figures. Step up onto this level, instructed another.
Ravenna guided his chair up over the lower steps onto the raised walkway, and his companions followed obediently until they all stood, waiting beside the housekeepers. They heard a rapid series of metal clanks and the whine of hydraulics. Slowly, ponderously, a broad circular platform descended from the domed roof space on heavy telescopic stanchions. The platform fitted concentrically over the lower floor space, but was several meters smaller in diameter. It lowered until it was precisely as far above the level of the raised walkway as the walkway was above the lower floor, creating a third tier to the chamber. The edge of the circular platform met the top of the steps jutting up and out from the raised circuit and locked in place with a thump of mag bolts. There was enough headroom beneath it for a man to descend to the lower floor space and walk around without ducking. The circular platform was a thick and pitted disc of iron or steel, with the six elevator stanchions, each one currently at full extension, rising like columns at regular intervals around its rim. Above it, black girders and the beams of the dome space slowly became illuminated by the gradually intensifying ghost glare of a dozen photolumen lamps. The open space of the platform was empty apart from a single object, a half-open door, held upright in the center of the platform by its frame. The door was very old and made of wood, a very ordinary old door in a very ordinary frame. They all stared at it for a moment. Above them, the house altered its foothold once more, and the motion caused the old door to swing back and forth in its frame slightly, as if blown by a breeze. It thumped to, and then swung open a hand's breadth ajar.
I give in. What is it?
Asked Nail.
A door,
replied Angharad, who, Ravenna had found, could always be relied upon for a prosaic answer.
A door? Carl echoed. Could it be what I think it is?
It rather depends on what you think it is, Carl, Ravenna replied. The housekeepers moved past them in procession, carrying lamps up the steps onto the door platform and arranging them around the edges of the disc. Ravenna lifted up onto the platform too and approached the door. The others slowly followed him.
A propylium tripartite?
Thonius ventured, speaking in hushed tones.
Tri-portal?
That was my thought, Ravenna said. Again, your deduction is excellent, as is your knowledge of abstruse lore and esoterica. Where have you come across the concept?
Carl shrugged. I remember finding references to the idea in study years ago. I can't remember the reference.
Sanix Codex Atrox,
Balak said quietly,
and also the Ochre Book.
He looked around at Ravenna and Thonius.
Access to such works is restricted, but, like Carl, I have made use of my interrogator status for the purpose of study. 3 years ago, working with Inquisitor Fenks on Mayapois, we were called to investigate a cult, which, it was claimed, operated a functional propylium tripartite. It proved to be a hoax, but I did my research. This design matches the woodcuts in Sarnik's work.
Sarnik.
Thonius nodded.
That's the fellow.
Are we supposed to believe this is a genuine triportal?
Balak asked, walking around to the far side of the doorframe so they could see him through the half-open door.
Anyone fancy, I don't know,
Nail murmured,
telling me what you're talking about?
Carl, Balak, Ravenna asked. Thonius took a step forward until he was on the opposite side of the door to Balak. He approached it gingerly. The door thumped slightly and loosely in its frame, as if caught by a persistent breeze.
A propylaeum tripartite, Carl said.
You keep saying that,
Nail chided.
A three-way door,
Carl Thonius corrected with a disdainful look at the heavy bounty man.
A mythical device of augury and divination. Its matter of function has never been explained, not even in psionic terms, though it may simply be a totem for psychic focus. An elaborate fetish.
How does it work? Asked Kiss. I mean, in what way does it work?
It has one side here, said Thonius.
And a second here,
said Balak, from the other side of the door.
But if one passes through the door...
Balak hesitated. Neither he nor Thonius showed any willingness to perform that act.
Well, Kiss, it is said that one finds a third side. A third way. The door transports the subject to another location in space-time entirely, a site where the answer to a specific question of augury may be learned.
A portal? Asked Kiss.
Balak shrugged.
Yes, a portal, said Ravenna. The door is said to be able to convey a subject elsewhere. In fact, to more than one place, depending on the sequence of use and the complexity of the answer sought after.
He swung his chair away from the door. The others grouped around him.
I wasn't expecting this, Ravenna said, which was foolish of me. Unless it proved to be fraudulent, the witch house was always going to contain a truly dark secret. This is what we came all this way to find. I just don't like the idea of using it.
Me neither, said Thonius.
I'm still struggling with the basic concept,
Nail admitted.
It's just an old wooden door, Angharad repeated, leadenly.
We have to use it.
They all turned to regard Kiss. She was watching the housekeepers set out the fluttering lamps and tapers around the rim of the platform.
We've come all this way, like you said. We've broken every rule we care about. We knew we would be tampering with the dark, the heretical. I don't like this one bit, but we're in it now. We're committed.
What are you suggesting?
Thonius asked her.
What are you suggesting? Kiss snapped back. Do we turn away? Go home? Give up? If we were going to do that, Throne help me, we should have done it months ago. We've come too far to get squeamish now.
You're right, Patience. Thank you for being the voice of reason.
I don't feel very reasonable.
We are doing this, Ravenna said. Well, some of us are. I won't risk the entire group. I need to leave someone here to cover our backs.
That's assuming, said Angharad archly,
that this isn't just an old wooden door flapping in the breeze.
Assuming that it isn't, said Ravenna,
perhaps you'd like to come with me and find out? Balak, Carl, you too, please. Harlan, you and Patience stay put and keep watch over this flapping door.
A dark look crossed Nail's face. He glanced at the swordswoman.
No, I...
he began. He stopped short.
She'll be fine with me, Harlan. I promise. I'll take care of her. Besides, she can take care of herself.
And her mind is wonderfully strong. Marvelously resilient.
There is a great deal of unworldliness she can withstand.
Nail glowered.
But I need your strength here. I need Kiss here, too, as a psychic link. Don't argue, Nail.
I'd never argue with you. Harlan, I know how much you care about the Carthayan. I know everything. I will protect her.
Nail nodded, grudgingly. He caught Angharad's eye and made the fist a sternum punch salute of the clans. She returned it. Ravana caught Kiss's mind intimately.
I'll try casting to you.
I'll be listening for you.
Keep us grounded, Patience.
I will.
The entire rim of the platform was by then flickering with candles and lamps. More lamps had been brought over onto the raised walkway, too. The theatre chamber's overhead lights dimmed to a slight glimmer. The flutter of whispering voices swirled around them once more, for the first time in half an hour. The moment they ceased, the door slammed shut tight with a loud bang, and they heard the ancient lock turn.
The house is ready for you,
said one of the housekeepers.
The door is ready to be unlocked,
said another. They stood in a ragged circle around Ravana's team on the disk. Who has the right key? Asked Ravana. Another chilling murmur of whispers. One of the housekeepers stepped forward, taking hold of the key it wore around its neck.
I do,
the housekeeper said. The other housekeepers muttered softly, as if congratulating the chosen one.
Who goes and who stays?
Asked another of the hooded figures.
I'm staying, replied Kiss.
Me too,
Nail grunted. The housekeeper motioned for them to follow. All but the chosen housekeeper processed slowly off the upper platform onto the walkway below. Kiss walked after them. She paused and looked back.
The Emperor protects, she called out.
Not this time, I'm afraid.
Then you protect Gideon, she said.
She turned and walked down the steps. Nail moved to go after her. He stopped and then strode deliberately back to Angharad and kissed her roughly on the lips.
Damn it, he growled. I want to see you all again alive. Even you, Thonius.
I'll be counting the minutes, dear heart,
Carl grinned back. Nail turned and plodded across the platform towards the steps. He thumped down them and stood beside Kiss, amongst the silent housekeepers, gazing up onto the door platform.
So, you and the warrior woman?
Kiss whispered.
Shut it.
How long has that been going on?
Two words, Kiss. Shut the frig up.
My lips are sealed, she smirked. Unlike yours, or hers.
He glared at her. She pointed up at the platform.
You're missing the show, she told him.
She turned to watch. Despite her smile, she had started to pray.
Are you content to begin?
Asked the housekeeper beside the door.
Oh, I can't wait, said Thonius.
Angharad looked bored. Balak rested his good hand on the grip of his holstered weapon.
We are content, Ravana replied.
The housekeeper removed the key from around its neck and slid it into the door's ancient lock. The key turned with a loud, unlubricated clack. The door opened. Thonius snorted. Through the open frame they could see the other side of the platform disk, the uninterrupted ring of the flickering lamps and tapers.
I'm really impressed so far, Thonius remarked.
Quiet.
This way,
the housekeeper instructed, ushering them through the open doorway. They stepped forward. The door slammed behind them and locked itself. Nail turned to stare at Kiss. She was wide-eyed, startled, terrified.
Holy living shit,
Nail said.
Did you see?
I saw, said Kiss.
They'd watched their comrades and the chosen housekeeper step through the door, watch the door slam. Now there was nothing at all on the platform, except the closed and locked door. Chapter 11
What was that?
Plighton asked. Getting up suddenly.
What was what?
Asked Lusik. He had been playing jacks on his coat, spread out across the grill deck of the dock.
Like a door, Plighton replied, raising her shotgun. Like a door slamming somewhere.
The house is old and full of noises, the scrawny prospector remarked. Get used to it.
She ignored him, walked the length of the dock to the hatchway, and shone her lamp pack up the service tunnel. Nothing stirred. She opened her link.
Check again, she called.
Nothing to report, the pilot servitor crackled back from the docked underboat.
She retraced her steps through the spooky shadows of the corroded machinery. The dock lights flickered slightly as the house took another step. Chains rocked and swung. Lucic was sitting where she'd left him.
"What are you doing?" she asked sharply.
"Playing jacks," he replied.
"You were doing something with your coat," she snapped, aiming the shotgun.
"Yes, Maud. I was playing jacks on my coat." He gazed at her with his bulging thyroid eyes, his skinny face comically honest. "All right, then," she said, lowering her weapon and sitting back down on a rusting coil winder. "You're awful jumpy, Maud," Lucic observed.
"Don't talk to me."
"I'm struck by the distinct impression that Carl is about to say, 'I told you this was a waste of time.'"
"I told you this,"
he begins. His voice fails him. Like all of us, he is looking around, dumbstruck, astonished. I cannot believe it either. I reach out with almost instinctive alarm and sweep with my mind. This is no lie. Or if it is a lie, it is a lie impervious to the scrutiny of even a mind like mine. We are no longer on Eutokri, or, I'll wager, in the Saito system, or even in the Helican subsector. My chair's internal horologue has just failed, erased, and restarted. A condition of portal transit, perhaps, or an indication we are no longer even in the same year as the one we left. It is stunning and awful and fundamentally disconcerting. I look at Balak, open-mouthed, gazing into the distance, at Carl, bending down to touch the hot, dry dust, at Angharad, narrowing her eyes and slowly drawing her Carthian steel. Only the housekeeper, holding on to its wretched key, seems unperturbed. The hot wind flaps the housekeeper's dark robes. "Everybody all right?" I ask. We are standing in a sweltering dust bowl of gritty red dunes, surrounded by an ominous ring of jagged, black volcanic outcrops. A strong desert wind drives the dust up at us, and I hear it pattering off the shell of my chair. The sky is a red haze of sickly light and whirled cloud banks. There is a star, flaring and wounded, blood red like a gunshot wound to the sky. I have no idea where we are. I rotate my chair slowly, picked recording every millimeter of our surroundings on my chair's internal recorders. I use the chair's systems to sample the dust, the regolith, and the air, and ping out with my internal auspex. This is a dead place. The air temperature is soaring, and the rocks around us radiate hellish heat. This is real. This isn't a dream or a vision or an auto-seance trance. This is real. And I have to get used to that fact fast or lose my sanity. The door is behind me, standing anachronistically in the middle of nowhere, tall and firm and closed tight. I watch Balak move around it in a circle. He tries the handle and finds it locked.
"Master," he says to me.
He has seldom called me that. He must be very afraid. I circled the door myself, my chair's impellers gusting up eddies of dust. I go right around it. It is as solid and real as the new world around us. Shut tight, one side baking in the alien sun's glare, the other dark in shadow. The door itself casts a long, oblong shadow across the red dust.
"Oh, throne," Carl whines.
"I would like to know where,"
Angharad says, her sword in her hand.
"I would like to know exactly. I mean, where?"
"Be calm."
"I want to know where we are,"
Angharad snarls, glancing at the housekeeper.
"Calm."
I send a wave of reassurance into her, and stop her in her tracks before she has the housekeeper by the throat.
"Is this the place?"
I ask.
"Is this the place where I find my answer?"
"Well, I don't see Moloch anywhere around, so I'm guessing no,"
Carl whines.
"It won't be that simple," I tell him.
"Will it, housekeeper?"
"This is just the first step,"
the housekeeper replies in that oh-so-androgynous way they have.
"The first step. Your question was convoluted. The door will have to open several times, I believe."
"Then why are we here?"
Carl demands.
"Calm,"
I send again, to Carl this time.
This is a place the house wanted to show you. I don't know why,
the housekeeper says.
I am not told such things. It is not my function.
What happens now?
Balak asks. Of all of them, he has kept his head the best.
We wait,
says our hooded guide. I don't want to wait, Angharad says quickly. I don't want to stay here. Something's coming. I sense nothing, I say, checking.
I see nothing,
adds Balak. Something's coming, Angharad insists. Something bad. Eviscerex can taste it. The long steel is twitching in her hands. It is taking her trained double grip to contain it. Over that ridge, she says. I regard the ridge she has indicated, a long, low line of black basalt rising from the dunes like rotted teeth from a gum. I sense nothing, but there seems to be a gathering pall of dust closing in behind the wild outcrop.
For throne's sake, Carl snaps, I want to get out of here. Can we get out of here? Please?
Calm down, and then I feel it. I feel what they're all feeling. Doom. A creeping, penetrating sense of doom and fear, as intolerable as a pervasive red light. It pulls at my mind, dark, like a shadow in the warp.
I don't like this, says Balak.
Housekeeper.
We must wait for the door,
the housekeeper replies.
Damn the door! Damn the frigging door!
Carl cries. He throws himself at it, banging his hands against the wood and rattling the handle with futile effort.
Oh, throne master!
He races around to the other side and tries again.
Let us back! Let us through!
Stop it, Carl. Stop it now. But Carl Thonius won't stop it. The fear has gripped him. He hammers and hammers and hammers. In the theatre chamber, still and quiet, Kiss glanced at Nail.
Did you hear that? She asked.
They both looked at the door.
Nothing. Just the house settling again.
No, she said. Didn't you hear the banging? Like someone thumping on the other side of the door.
No,
he replied, without confidence. As they watched, the door's handle rotated to and fro, as if someone, somewhere, was trying to open it.
Shit,
said Nail, stepping forward. Kiss stopped him.
There's nothing we can do except wait, she told him.
Carl!
Ravenna's command pulled him back from the door. He was sweating profusely from the overwhelming heat and the fear.
Sorry,
he said.
Sorry.
Housekeeper, Ravenna asked. The housekeeper waited a moment or two longer, and then stepped forward and fitted the key back into the lock. It turned, and the door reopened.
This way,
the housekeeper said. They hurried through the doorway and let it slam shut behind them. Ravenna heard it lock again. Their body sweat turned clammy on their backs in an instant. Even more than before, they were overwhelmed by the sensation of being somewhere utterly and completely else. Not just because of the light and temperature conditions, but because of the infinitesimally altered pull of gravity, the imperceptible change of air pressure, the smell, the pheromone of the place. Balak drew his weapon. He glanced around. They were inside a stone cloister of imperial Gothic construction. It was old, and eroded by time and weather. They could all hear the bash of ocean breakers striking an invisible shore nearby. It was dark. Night. Stars were out in the clear black sky.
Master,
Thonius whispered. Ravenna was trying to reset his chair's internal horolog. Its jumping readings were nonsense.
Master!
Ravenna turned his perception outwards and scanned the location. I know this, he said.
The door is locked, announced Angharad.
The door stood behind them in the dim cloister, strange and out of place.
It's locked from either side, she added, having tried both.
Those stars, Ravenna said. Carl looked up.
I don't know them.
But we should, said Ravenna. I'm checking them against my data coils, trying to find a match. Wait. Wait.
We're in the Ordo Malleus chapter house, on Gudrun,
said Balak. He turned to look at them.
I wish I could claim some clever insight, sir, but it's written here on the wall.
Balak showed him the ancient faded plaque.
But this is a ruin, said Thonius.
They moved out along the cloister and into the crumbling, stunted wreckage of the chapter house that spread out across an overgrown headland. The place had been reduced to this state many years before. Weeds and climbing plants festooned the tumbled stones, twitching fretfully in the night wind off the sea.
I was here a year ago,
Balak cried.
It was intact, I swear. It was intact, and...
This isn't a year ago, or a year hence, Ravana said. I don't know when we are. I think the door is showing us some important consequence of fate. I believe we are in our own future. Look, said Angharad. Across the bay, where the night sea crashed relentlessly against a broken shore, they could see the desolate, empty silhouette of a great city. It had been dead for many years. Great throne of Terra, Ravana murmured. That's Dorsay. He rotated his chair to face the housekeeper. Take us back through the door, he said.
The door is not ready.
Take us back through the door, now.
The door opened and closed behind them again, thanks to the housekeeper's key. A summer evening waited on the other side. The long, low rake of a recently harvested field stretched down in the easy light towards a bank of hedges, with trees beyond. A slowly fading sky above was ribboned with white clouds that were just taking on the colours of dusk. 100 meters away down the field, a plain wooden chair sat forlorn amongst the hewn, dry strands of the crop. Birds sang, twittering overhead in the twilight and chasing in the hedgerows. A few early stars had come out in the depth of the sky. A lone figure was toiling up the field towards the chair. Ravana turned his own chair and regarded his companions. They stood in front of the locked door, which rose improbably from the field crest behind them. Stay here, Ravana instructed.
But,
Balak began, stay here and do nothing unless I signal. He coasted away across the dead stubble and followed the slope of the field down towards the lonely wooden seat. The figure was approaching, walking up into the twilight air with confidence and effort. Ravana approached the waiting chair. He stopped short 10 meters away. The residue of the harvested crop, the remaining stalks, had been carefully raked and twisted into a circle around the wooden chair. The circle was 5 meters in diameter, with the wooden seat at its dead center. Ravana recognized the complex weaving and design of the circle's rim. He hovered outside it, waiting, as the figure approached up the slope. The figure arrived, stepped into the corn circle, and sat down on the chair. He was breathing hard. The legs of the old wooden chair rested unevenly in the loose soil and set him at an angle.
Well, hello,
the man on the chair said at last, dabbing at his brow with a handkerchief. He was a portly man in late middle age, dressed in a high-buttoned green silk suit. His thick, dark hair and beard were perfectly groomed.
I was wondering when you'd get here. You are Gideon Ravana, aren't you? Of course you are. So, we meet, finally, face to face.
He leaned forward.
Do you know who I am?
Yes, said Ravana.
Excellent,
replied Orfeo Calzean.
So, let's talk.
Chapter 12 Maud Plighton was pacing. Her footsteps rang up and down the docking pool's deck. Lusik watched her with some amusement. She looked at her link wistfully, but for the umpteenth time decided she shouldn't disturb whatever was taking place in the upper chambers of the house. She was slipping the link back in her coat pocket when she heard a muffled sound. What was that? She demanded, turning to look at Lusik. What was what? He grinned at her. I heard a noise.
This again. Maud, come on. You're so jumpy. You're getting quite paranoid.
Plighton stepped towards him and brought the heavy combat shotgun up.
I heard a noise, she hissed.
The trill tone of a link.
You're imagining it.
Get up and back away, she told him. Lusik rose and took a few steps backwards down the dock. He left his coat spread out on the decking, the loose jack pieces scattered across it. keeping her eyes on Lusik, her gun raised in her right hand. She stooped and lifted the coat by the collar and threw it over the decking.
"Hey!"
Lusik cried. The jack pieces tumbled away across the deck, and most fell through the grill into the water below. Kneeling, Plighton patted down the empty coat with her left hand, feeling into the pockets, her eyes never leaving the prospector.
"Stuff your hay," she said.
Her left hand emerged from a deep pocket holding a worn, old link device.
"You lying bastard."
"Oh, come on," Lusik said.
"Since when was it against the rules to own a link?"
"Who were you talking to? Who are you signaling?" Lusik didn't reply. His meager mouth became tight and pinched below his blade of a nose.
"I don't know what you're talking about, Maud."
He looked down at the deck.
"Who was it, Lusik?"
He looked up at her again, a broad smile slowly extending across his face. Without turning, she knew why. She went cold. She felt the muzzle of a weapon press against the back of her head.
"Like I keep saying," said Lusik,
stepping forward and taking the shotgun from her.
"Out here, a man needs all the friends he can get."
Nail took a strip of dry jerky from his pocket and tore off a chunk with his teeth. He offered the fistful of food to Kiss. She shook her head.
"Waiting makes me hungry," he said.
The door had been silent for over an hour. Nail and Kiss idled on the raised walkway, sometimes walking up onto the top platform to take a closer look at the door. The housekeepers had all remained as still as statues.
"So, you and Angharad?" Kiss asked.
"It's a private thing."
"A private thing for how long?"
"Does it matter?"
"Will it matter to Gideon?"
Nail scowled.
"I don't want to hurt him, but it's none of his business."
"You must have known it would matter to him, or you wouldn't have hidden it."
"Shut up, Kiss. You don't know anything."
"You know I do."
She paused suddenly and looked away.
"Nail."
He was already reaching for his sidearm, but it was too late. The heavy hatches around the theater chamber's walls slammed open, and figures surged in onto the raised walkway. A dozen grizzled, hard-bodied men in grubby combat armor and fur-trimmed hostile environment suits. They aimed their las carbines and shotguns with a professional confidence that matched their stony expressions. Nail and Kiss froze and slowly raised their hands. There was no cover, no room to resist. One of the men pushed the barrel of his carbine into Nail's face while he reached over and confiscated the bounty hunter's sidearm.
"Who are you?"
asked Nail. None of them answered. Two of them were herding the housekeepers into a tight huddle. Meek, the housekeepers made no sound or any gesture of resistance.
"Watch the woman,"
a voice echoed out across the chamber. Nail and Kiss turned. A large figure was walking around the circuit towards them, accompanied by two more hired guns. His carapace armor gleamed like mother-of-pearl in the lamplight. His head was a mass of livid scar tissue, with a bleached stripe of hair across his scalp. He held a psi scanner in one gauntleted hand.
"She's telekinetic," he said.
He glared at Kiss and waved the scanner at her.
"One hint of psi, I'll know it, and you'll be dead." "Lucius Friggin Warner,"
Nail growled. The massive bounty hunter regarded Nail.
"Long time, Nail," he said. "I see you've fallen on hard times, scrabbling for dung work like this. Working for the throne, brother. Shit, I'm disappointed in you. Gives our kind a bad name." "You do that all by yourself,"
Nail replied. Kiss stared at Lucius Vorner. This was the callous monster who had tortured and mutilated Sholto Unworth. The last they'd heard of him, he'd been working for the opposition. She had no doubts he still was, and that meant...
"What happens?"
Nail asked.
"Oh, it's happened already,"
Vorner replied.
"You tried a little gambit, but we outplayed you. We've won. You've lost. End of story."
Chapter 13. So, this is a trap. Orfeo Kalzean gestured around himself with both hands, indicating both the harvested field and the twilight sky.
This is not a trap. This is a conversation.
But the witch house, the three-way door. That was a trap, Ravenna said. Kalzean chuckled.
Trap this, trap that, trap, trap, trap. I suppose it must be the Inquisitor in you that makes you so very suspicious all the time, Gideon. May I call you Gideon, incidentally?
You may not. I watch for traps all the time because Zygmunt Moloch is supremely gifted at setting them, and he's caught me more than once before. Kalzean thought about that.
Well,
he said gently,
if it is a trap, it would be safe to conclude you're not getting any better at spotting them, are you?
I've never underestimated Moloch's guile, Ravenna replied. The only thing I seem to keep underestimating is his talent for coming back from the dead. He scanned around, gently. On his seat in the warded ring of corn, Kalzean was a blank. There were human life signs in the woods behind him, support, no doubt, but too far away to be an immediate threat. Thonius, Balak, and Angharad remained at the top of the hilly field, watching from beside the door. Where is Moloch? Ravenna asked. Is he too afraid to face me himself?
Where is Moloch? That's the question, isn't it? The big question, the one you came to Utokri to answer. I think the door's done a splendid job of answering you. It's brought you here. Moloch is close by, but I am much better at this kind of negotiation. I don't know how much you know about me.
Enough not to underestimate you, either. But you're not like Moloch. You're a different breed of evil altogether. A facilitator. A mercenary. A prostitute.
Well, let's not bandy semantics, shall we?
Kalzean frowned.
This should be amicable. A conversation between peers.
Birds sang high in the darkening sky above them. Their songs seemed painfully innocent to Ravenna. You have arranged all this so we can talk? Ravenna asked.
No, actually, replied Kalzean.
He settled back.
It's quite the most curious thing. It arranged itself. Oh, I had to make a few judicious improvements and alterations so it would all run smoothly, but generally, this just happened.
His eyes sparkled with enthusiastic cunning.
That's just amazing, isn't it? That's why I decided we had to talk.
So, talk. Kalzean nodded and brushed corn chaff off the hem of his jacket.
To business, then. I'll keep it simple. You have been chasing Zygmunt Moloch for a long time, and with due cause, I will admit. If I was an Imperial Inquisitor, perish the thought, I would have made it my life's work to hunt him down, too. The pair of you dance and dance around each other, jabbing and sparring, daring and thwarting. You've done it for years. You'll be doing it forever, I believe, unless someone intervenes and brings matters to a head.
Is that someone you...
In part. Working on Zygmunt's behalf, I have discovered some strange facts, Gideon. I found out things I don't think either of you are aware of.
Such as?
The pair of you are bound by destiny. Bound by a single, shared destiny.
That's merely a fanciful and melodramatic way of describing my ongoing prosecution of the heretic Zygmunt Moloch. If that's the best you can...
Whoa, whoa!
Kalzean said, raising a hand.
Settle down. I mean it literally, as it happens. Right at the start, the first time you met, something happened that spliced you together in a grand cosmic design.
And what is that design?
Ah, that's why I wanted to talk to you.
This is just nonsense. Make your play if you're going to. My people are ready. Ravenna cast out a simple command, and, on the crest of the hill behind him, his three companions drew their weapons.
I don't want to fight you, said Kalzean. That's the point. All the time we're fighting each other, we're missing what's really important. And what's really important is slight.
Ravenna paused. You have 2 minutes, Kalzean. Kalzean licked his lips and smiled.
You came all the way to Utokri because you believed it was the only way you'd find out where Zygmunt was hiding. A good plan. A very good plan, in fact, because Zygmunt had the very same idea. When we made our exit from Tancred, Zygmunt decided that the only way he could ever be safe from you, truly safe, was to consult the future and find out your part in it. He wanted coherence, too. Isn't that funny? Both of you deciding to take precisely the same course of action?
He leaned forward and tapped an index finger against his temple.
It's because you think the same way. Bound in destiny, remember?
Ravenna didn't reply.
We arrived at Eutokri about 3 weeks ahead of you. I made the appropriate arrangements and secured us a consultation at the witch house. And what was the first thing we found out when the door opened? That you were coming to the witch house too, hell-bent on the same scheme. That took me aback, I can tell you. Zygmunt, for his part, was delighted. He was all for setting a final and very nasty trap for you. And we've established his penchant for traps already. But I talked him out of it. The whole thing fascinated me, piqued my facilitator's mind. I think along different lines to Zygmunt, you see. We perceive different patterns, which is why we complement each other. Zygmunt saw it all as moves in a great game. You and he as pieces on a regicide board, one stratagem outstepping the next, blah, blah, blah. But I was scared.
Scared?
Of the implications. There are coincidences, and there are coincidences. A great deal can be dismissed on the basis of your shared history and experiences. You have similar knowledge, similar talents, and although it's a blood rivalry, you walk in similarly dark places. Both of you simultaneously decide to come to the witch house. I can accept that. Coincidence. But what brought you both to Eustace Majoris? What brought you to the other worlds where you've clashed?
We're antagonists, Kulzean. I'm hunting him. It's not hard to grasp.
What about Tancred? Of all the places in the sector, you tracked him to Tancred. We left no trail that you could have followed. What brought you there? A hunch?
Again, Ravenna didn't answer.
I'm right, aren't I?
Smiled Kulzean. He stroked his beard.
A hunch. A hunch here, a little intuition there, a handful of happenstance and accident. Doesn't it scare you too? Just a little bit.
What's your explanation? And don't say shared destiny.
This is what I decided to find out. I sat down with Zygmunt and interviewed him over a period of days. He told me of your past encounters already, but I wanted to hear them from him again, every last detail. He kindly and patiently told me everything. And that's when I saw it, clear as day, the way the two of you had been bound.
He rose to his feet and walked around the wooden chair, staying within the corn ring.
You have been bound by the forces of the warp, Gideon. Bound together to accomplish a great task. Neither of you realizes you're being used. Left to your own devices, I doubt either of you would have ever realized it. Apart, perhaps, for one brief, gurgling moment of insight as death claimed you. The warp has chosen you, selected you both carefully, and set you about its work. Without realizing it, as you wage your sporadic bloody squabble down the years, you are acting as facilitators. As midwives.
For slight, Ravenna said. Kulzean clapped his hands.
Sharp as a new crown. I knew I wouldn't be disappointed in you, Gideon. Yes, for slight. The ruinous powers want slight to be born. Don't ask me why, because they don't copy me in on their meetings.
Kulzean snorted at his own words.
But you can bet it's going to be bloody horrible.
The birth of Slight was predicted, said Ravenna uneasily. The Frattery predicted it. You were there, Kulzean. The hour has passed. The prophecy was unfulfilled.
Was it? Was it really?
Kulzean looked at Ravenna as if he knew something.
Or has it already happened? Or, look at it this way, Gideon. The birthing of a demon in our reality is likely to be a long and protracted labor. There will be complications. If, let's agree for a moment, you and Zygmunt have been obliviously working towards this end since the first day you met, then the birth pangs have lasted, what, 60 years already?
66, if you're right.
Not an easy birth,
Kulzean mused.
Not an easy birth at all.
How are you suggesting the ruinous powers bound us, Kalzean? Explain how I could have been used by the arch-enemy for so long without realizing it. I am no one's pawn.
Please, no pawn ever realizes he or she is a pawn, said Kalzean. And look at you. You've broken from the Ordos, gone rogue, and come to Yutokri hunting heretical divination. You're not exactly pure.
How did the warp bind us? Ravenna repeated. Kalzean waved his hands in frustration.
At your first meeting, Sleef Outworld. I haven't got time to fill in all the blanks for you, Gideon. You're smart. You figure it out. We've got more important things to consider right here.
Like?
Like the very purpose of this meeting.
He paused.
I'm proposing a truce. A pooling of resources towards a common goal.
A truce? That's a spectacularly unlikely notion, Kalzean. In fact, it sounds to me very much like the groundwork of one of Moloch's elaborate traps.
If we wanted you dead, said Kalzean, you'd have been dead by now. We've kept you alive because there's a good chance you and Zygmunt need each other. You need to come together to defy the ruinous powers and stop Slight.
Ravenna rolled his chair back a little way. Tell me, Kalzean, why would a fiend like Moloch even want to stop Slight? It sounds like the sort of thing he would ordinarily be working his fingers to the bone to accomplish. Kalzean sat down again.
You don't really understand us, do you, Gideon? You don't really understand our beliefs and our ambitions. We're just evil, an evil to be stopped, and all evil is the same to you. It carries the same weight. Me, Zygmunt, Slight. You're so blinkered.
He stared at Ravenna intently.
You've been through the door, Gideon. I'll wager it showed you a future or two.
Pleasant? Inconclusive. But no, not pleasant.
I know what Zygmunt and I saw when we went through the door. A galaxy in flames. An age of apocalypse. Demon time. No Imperium except a burning shell, populated by the last dying dregs of mankind. You don't want that. I know you don't. You've spent your life defending society against just such a doom. We don't want it either. Our ambitions are wildly different to yours, Gideon, and in definite conflict. But Zygmunt and I can only flourish, prosper, and achieve our own goals so long as the Imperium persists. The Imperium is our playground. Mankind, our instrument. We weave our schemes through the complex fabric of Imperial life to benefit ourselves. I'm not pretending you'd like what we want from our lives, but it would be nothing compared to demon time. Slight must be stopped. The alternative is too awful for any of us to contemplate.
A truce, Ravenna said. Moloch and I, working together, to defy the bond and destroy Slight. This is what you're proposing. Kalzean nodded.
If you agree, Gideon, I'll send you back through the door to Yutokri. I'll arrange for a message to be sent to you at Berinth, giving you this location, this world where we're sitting now. You bring your people here, and we start to plan in earnest.
If I refuse.
Then you'll never know where here is, and we'll have to manage on our own. The Imperium may suffer. If you refuse, go back through the door, and we'll say goodbye.
There was a long pause, stirred only by the evening breeze and the twitter of hedgerow birds. Goodbye, said Ravenna. He turned his chair around and began to glide back up the hill.
I'm disappointed, Kalzean called after him. Truly, I am. You're making a mistake.
Ravenna ignored him. He rejoined his companions at the top of the slope.
What's going on?
Asked Thonius.
Who was that man? Asked Angharad.
We're leaving, Ravenna said. Open the door, housekeeper. The housekeeper placed the key in the door's old lock. They looked back down the field for a moment. In the dusk, Orfeo Kalzean was still sitting on his chair in the corn ring, watching them. He raised his right hand to his lips and blew them a kiss.
I don't like this, Thonius said.
You haven't liked much of anything so far,
Balak snapped. "Open the door," Ravana repeated. The door creaked open. They saw the evening fields beyond the doorframe, the first stars now bright in the violet sky. They stepped through. Chapter 14. The dripping, stinking bowels of an underhive surrounded them. It was gloomy and oppressively muggy. Water, probably not rainwater, pattered down on them from high above, down the sheer ravine depths of the stack foundations. High above, 1,000 meters up, tiny moving dots showed the crisscross of upper-level air traffic buzzing between the hive towers. They heard running footsteps approaching down a nearby alley, a caterwauling laugh that sounded slightly insane. "This isn't right," Thonius said. "Not right at all." He looked at the housekeeper. "Why aren't we in the right place?"
"The route back is often not the same as the route there,"
the housekeeper said blandly.
"The door chooses."
"How many steps until we're back at the witch house?" asked Balak firmly.
"The door chooses. It's not my function,"
the housekeeper replied.
"Open the door again," said Ravana. The footsteps and laughter were getting closer.
"Whoever is approaching," said Angharad, "they're out of their minds on some substance. I can smell it on their sweat."
"You can smell anything above this general stink?" asked Thonius.
Angharad ignored him and looked at Ravana. "They will be violent. There will be violence."
"Open the door," Ravana repeated.
The housekeeper tried the key. It refused to turn.
"The door is not ready to be opened again."
"Open the door."
"We must wait until it is ready,"
the housekeeper said. Thonius flinched as shots banged off loudly in a stack sink nearby. They heard the distinct whine of a hard round spanking off stone. More laughter, shouts, a scream.
"Gangs," said Balak.
He raised his las pistol and took a careful aim at the alleyway end.
"Farmed up and juicing for an argument. First head around that wall gets a new nostril."
There were more shots, closer now, and more screaming laughter. Angharad took up a place beside Balak.
"Don't shoot them all," she told him. "Eviscerex thirsts."
"You realize I wouldn't be here to have all this fun if it wasn't for you,"
Balak said sarcastically.
"You can thank me later," she replied.
"Come on," said Thonius. "The door?"
The housekeeper tried the key. It turned. Red light. Hot wind. Red dust.
"Damn,"
said Balak, raising his arm to shield his eyes from the gritty wind.
"Not this again," said Thonius.
The black volcanic rock loomed in the distance above the sculpted red dunes. The heat from the gunshot star burned their skins.
"Not here again," he murmured.
For all her bravado in the underhive, Angharad was immediately spooked.
"This is a bad place, and we have to leave it now," she declared. "Something is coming."
She was right. Even Ravana could feel it in the back of his mind, a crawling itch, the same sense of impending doom that had surrounded them the last brief time they had passed through the Red Desert. The housekeeper was clearly affected, too. Without having to be asked or ordered, the housekeeper put the key in the lock and attempted to turn it. The door remained defiantly locked.
"Come on, come on," Thonius sobbed.
The wind picked up, scooping sand from the ground and winnowing it around them. The housekeeper tried the door again.
"Come on,"
screamed Thonius. The housekeeper began rattling the key furiously and then started banging at the door.
"It won't open,"
the housekeeper cried. It was the first emotional expression any of the housekeepers had made.
"It won't open. My key doesn't work."
"No,"
cried Thonius. "Keep trying," Ravana said.
"Oh, look. By the blood of my clan, look,"
Angharad called. Something had appeared, cresting the line of black rocks. It looked like a wave at first, like fast-flowing liquid spilling over the rocks in a flood and rushing on across the duned regolith towards them. But it wasn't liquid.
"Open the door," said Ravana firmly.
"It won't open,"
the housekeeper screamed back. The wave was made of organisms, a swarm of fast-moving black-and-white creatures.
They came on in a rippling, scurrying tide, chittering and yapping. Organic armor glinted like lacquered steel in the sunlight. The organisms were man-sized bipeds with torsos and heads hunched low and forward like sprinters, and rigid, spiked tails held out high to counterbalance them. Their limbs and bellies gleamed off-white like dirty ice, but their backs and long heads were a polished onyx black where the armor was thickest. Dead, black eyes, mere slits, gazed out from behind heavy nasal horns. The snapping, chittering mouths were full of needle teeth. Four sickle-hook arms were neatly folded under their upper bodies. There was a smell coming off them that was even more distressing than the clicking, chattering cries they were making. The smell was worse because it was not like anything any of them had smelled before. It was dry and musky and caustic, like wood polish, like fermented fruit mash, like the funerary spices of a mummified corpse. It was all of those things and none of them. It was alien in the most extreme sense. "Please, please, open the door!" Thonius begged. Bounding, sprinting, clicking, the wave bore down on the figures at the lonely door, gleaming, jostling black and white bodies, and bouncing counterbalance hails. They were so fast, so agile, so many. Regolith dust rose in a shimmering cloud above them, lifted by their scurrying feet.
"Holy throne!"
Balak managed to stammer. The front of the wave was on them, long hooked limbs flicked up to strike.
"Open the door!"
wailed Thonius.
"It's too late," said Ravenna.
Part 3. The Long Way Round. Chapter 1. She was freezing cold. Lucic had taken her environment coat off her in an act of petty spite.
"That's for losing my jacks," he had said sullenly, tossing her garment off the dock into the pool.
Lucic's friend was evidently a bounty hunter or hired gun, tall and coarse, with a well-conditioned body of sinewy muscle, and a face that had been decorated with puckered burn tissue down one side. He wore a body glove armored with reinforcing plates and a quilted, fur-trimmed jacket. His weapon of choice was a cut-down las carbine, ex-guard issue. The man himself was probably ex-guard issue, too. He'd searched Plighton unsympathetically for concealed weapons, tugging out the little Transvasa insurance she kept stowed in her waistband. His grubby hands had gone everywhere, and he'd been smiling while he worked. "Pig," Plighton had called him when he was done. Without hesitation, he had smacked her hard across the face with the back of his hand and knocked her onto the deck.
"Hey, don't," Lucic had cried out.
"What's she to you?"
Burnface had asked. The look in Burnface's eyes had forced Lucic to shrug and back down. Not so much a friend, after all. Down on the deck, her face stinging and her eyes hot, Plighton had noticed this detail. Burnface had dragged her up roughly and forced her to sit on an empty lube drum.
"Don't move," he had instructed.
It was hard to track the time, but she figured an hour must have passed. Lucic put on his coat and started to pace. Plighton's combat shotgun slung over his lanky shoulder. Burnface had briefly dropped down into the underboat and then returned, chewing on a ration bar from the boat's supply. He had several other bars stuffed into his coat pocket.
"So, what's the play?"
Lucic had asked the hired gun lightly.
"We stay planted here and wait for the word,"
Burnface had replied, munching. He ate fast and messily, like a wild animal. He sat down on a coil winder and chewed some more. After a while, he rested his carbine against his leg and took out Plighton's Transvasa. He started to play with it, stripping it out, popping the clip, and flicking the safety on and off. He aimed it at several imaginary targets around the docking pool to gauge its qualities.
"Nice piece," he remarked.
He looked at Plighton. She avoided his gaze. The cold was getting to her bones. She was shivering, and sat with her arms wrapped around her body. Burnface ate another ration bar and threw the waxed paper wrapper into the pool. Through the grill decking, Plighton could see it floating beneath her in the grease ice beside her slowly sinking coat. The hired gun patted his pockets.
"Got a smoke? Low or something?"
he asked Lucic.
"I'm out,"
said Lucic, distractedly,
taking out his link and staring at it as if willing it to chime. Burnface looked at Plighton.
You?
She shook her head. Then, on inspiration, added, They were in my coat. Burnface glared at Lusick.
You daft bastard,
he growled. Out here, a man needs all the friends he can get, eh? Well, Lusick, you're losing your only one fast.
Best find something else to do, to pass the time.
Burnface mused. He looked at Plighton again.
You cold?
She nodded.
Maybe we get you a little colder still, then warm you up some.
Hey, Lusick said. Don't be getting nasty with her. The bounty hunter got to his feet.
Don't be getting nasty,
he replied, mimicking Lusick's prissy outrage.
Frig you. Nasty is what we do.
Even so.
I was told you were in on this. I was told you could be counted on.
I can, said Lusick hastily. I did what you people wanted, didn't I? I did it right. The bounty hunter shrugged. He was chasing a lodged scrap of ration bar out of his teeth with his tongue. He found the scrap and spat it out.
Big boys' games now,
he told Lusick.
Big boys' rules. You better keep up.
I can keep up.
So, why you so protective of this bitch?
Lusick began. I didn't know we'd have to kill all of them.
Maybe we won't. Maybe we can all be very good friends. We'll see. They'll call and tell us how it pans out.
If it's a no?
Don't worry,
Burnface said, sitting back down and taking out Plighton's transvasor again.
That time comes, I'll do her. If you know what I mean.
Lusick scowled and resumed pacing the deck. The bounty hunter eased back on his seat and stared at the lapping water below. Another 10 minutes crawled by. Plighton was getting so bone cold she was afraid she might shut down. Hypothermia. If she passed out, Throne help her. There was a rumble and a shudder. The hanging chains in the wharf area, some of them massive, trembled and swung. The house was adjusting its stance again. Chunks of grubby ice that had formed around the chain links were dislodged by the movement and splashed down into the pool.
It's taken too long, Lusick said. It takes as long as it takes.
I'm going to call up, Lusick said, taking out his link again. Burnface shrugged.
Knock yourself out.
Lusick keyed his link. Hello? Copy back. This is Lusick in the dock. What's taken so long up there?
I don't need your frigging agitation in my ear, Lusick.
Vorna snarled into his wrist-mounted link.
We're sitting tight, so sit tight with us. I'll tell you woe or go as soon as there's a woe or go to tell you.
The witch house's theater chamber was painfully silent. Vorna's paid guns had spread out around the room in a securing spread. The housekeepers had been forced down in a little huddle of seated figures, with two men watching them. The candles and lamps flickered. Kiss and Nail sat side by side on the raised walkway with their backs against the outer wall. Two men had been posted to watch them, too. One of them had been given the eye scanner and was studying it closely, as if his life depended on it. Which it does, Nail thought, in a small, savored moment of optimism. Vorna was standing on the upper platform, staring at the closed, silent door. They'd heard his side of the Voxlink exchange. At the mention of Lusick's name, Nail had risked a look at Kiss. She met the look. Lusick. Betrayed. Vorna clumped down the steps to rejoin them. He towered over their seated figures, then squatted down. Kiss could smell his breath. Gutter meat. Bad rations.
Taking a long time,
he offered, almost comradely.
I don't know what's taking a long time because I don't know what's going on, Kiss replied.
Not so much talk from you, witch,
Vorna grumbled in his penetratingly low voice. He looked at Nail.
What the hell happened to you?
He asked.
Life happened,
Nail replied coldly. Vorna frowned.
We saw some fine times in the old days, you and me, and the others. Scored plenty. Now look at you, taking the throne's coin. What drives a man to do that, I wonder? I got a good offer. From the Ordos, Vorna laughed. This Ravenna cripple? Originally, no. His master, Eisenhorn,
Nail replied.
Oh, yeah. I heard of him. Eisenhorn. Tough old bird. But he's dead, right? That's what I was told. I think he's dead. And now you throw your lot in with this crippled scumbag. You wouldn't understand. No?
Lucius Vorna shrugged.
Maybe not. This isn't some frigging loyalty thing, is it? Please, please, powers that be, don't tell me Harlan frigging Nail went and got himself a conscience.
Nail laughed despite himself and shook his head.
Walk with me,
Vorna said, rising and beckoning Nail to follow him. Nail got up and joined Vorna in a long, slow circuit of the railed deck.
You want a smoke?
Vorna asked.
A smoke would be good.
Vorna flicked his fingers, and one of his men proffered a pack of low sticks. They took one each, and the man lit them obediently. Kiss watched. The Harlan Nail she knew never smoked these days. Lucius Vorna took a deep draw and exhaled. Nail toyed with his low stick rather more circumspectly.
Wanted to get you away from that witch,
Vorna confided.
She's bad news. If you say so. If I say so. What is this, be nice to Lucius week? You got the guns. You got the manpower. Hell, you got the drop, Lou. What the frig else am I going to do except be nice to you?
Vorna chuckled.
In your place, I'd do the same. But then, you always knew how to play a scene, didn't you, Nail? I've had my moments. Hell yeah. Good work. We did good work. You remember, what's his name? Probably. What was his name? Shinto. Shinko. Shimko. Some frig like that. Alex Shinato. That's the frigger,
Vorna exclaimed.
Throne, that was a good day. Sarum on the lookout. You got a tip on the down low, and we were in. But how many frigging gun-happy trogs did that guy have waiting for us? Almost too many,
Nail admitted.
Almost too many, that's a fact. Laz like confetti. Bracer bought it right off. Bracer was a stump,
said Nail.
He was asking to be wiped the day he applied for his license. Yeah, that's true.
They walked on a little way.
I was in the chasm that day, Nail,
said Vorna.
Pinned. Took one in the leg. Still pains me. But you came through. Cleanest kill shots I ever saw, no lie. The two stiffs with the cannon, then Shinto himself. End of story. Shinato.
Vorna grunted.
He's dead. What does it matter? I'm the one pinned now, Lou. Yes. Yes, you are. Never seems fair to me,
Nail remarked, knocking the ash off his low stick.
We work for coin. Always have. It's never about ties or bonds or loyalties. I saved your life that day, but it doesn't count now.
Maybe so. Maybe no,
Vorna replied.
This is why I wanted to talk to you, in private, so to speak.
I don't like to see you go swirling down the head with these other mongrels. There'd be a place for you. Just say the word. A place.
Vorna gestured around them.
I got a new crew together, with a good source of retainer fees. All the perks. These bastards are the best, but I could always use another good gun. Say the word, and you're working for me. You're joking. I've been serving the Inquisition for decades. I know. But like you said, we work for coin. No ties, no bonds, no loyalties. You've been working for pay, and pay is what I'm offering. Since when did you or me care who was servicing our bill? This is because you owe me?
Asked Nail.
This is precisely because I owe you. My life, I owe you. I'm offering you your life in payment of that debt. Join my crew. I can swear it with Kulzian. Pays, sweet, Did I mention that? I don't like the thought of you skull-shot with the others, and I have a strong feeling that's how it's going to end. Come and play with the winning team. Now, before it's too late.
Nail drew on his low stick.
Nice offer. Tempting. But how the frig would you ever trust me? Hello? Ordo work for decades, remember? Well, murmured Vorna, you'd have to prove yourself. To me and the crew. How?
Lucius Vorna looked back around the chamber to where Kiss was sitting under guard. He slid a vicious combat dagger out of his hip rig.
Got the frigging Telekine witch for me, would you?
Nail blinked. Then he smiled and took hold of the blade.
Make it last, Lucius Vorna advised.
Chapter 2 Leaping, bounding, skipping, they pour down over us under the red heat of the gunshot sun. Their chitter hits us first, then their stink, and then the impressing weight of their torrent. Carl is screaming. The housekeeper is screaming. Both are hammering at the unyielding door. I know the door is sealed and will not open because I know this is a trap. Zygmunt Moloch's last, best, and most horrific trap. The first of them land on me, scraping their hook blades off my chair's hull. The weight of them pushes my chair down into the dust and threatens to topple me. There is a sour stink of the adrenal hormone driving their aggression. What are these chattering creatures, these monsters? They are unknown to me, unknown to Imperial law. What does it matter anyway? They are death. They are my death. Balak is firing his weapon, yelling out. The wave rolling in on him falters, punctured. Vile purplish ichor explodes from shot-blasted bodies and clumps the dry sand where it splashes. Angharad, no wonder Harlan is so enamored of her. She's like a fury, standing her ground, her long steel swinging. Limbs fly off, hooked members flipping and spinning away through the air. Snouts are truncated, horns are turned aside, hooks deflected. Ichor sprays, Eviscerex bites. The Ul Waila Skri, the genius of sharpness. I doubt any Carthaian in clan history has ever faced down such a foe single-handed. She is magnificent. She turns and spins, kicks and slices, driving the organisms back, damaged and slain. I estimate she will last another minute and a half. Carl turns from the door, firing his auto-pistol wildly. He scores hits. It's difficult not to, given the sheer wall of squirming menace driving into us. Leaping forms burst in midair and tumble, twitching. These are impossible odds. We are going to die. Hook blades squeal and scrape against my chair's surface. We are going to die. How quickly is up to me. I fling the increasing layers of gouging, yapping bodies off me with a mind flick. Some of the creatures sail back a long way into the ranks behind them. Righting my chair, I send out another telekinetic burst that pulps the front rank in a blizzard of purple-black jelly and shattering chitin. I am an Imperial Inquisitor. I will not go down without a fight. I pop my weapon modules out of my chair's chassis. Paired psi cannons. I open fire and blitz the black and white organisms bounding towards me. Balak has drawn his backup weapon, an auto-snub. He fires into the oncoming swarm. There's been no time to reload his las. Eviscerex rips and shreds. Bodies are opened, bisected. Hind limbs, still attached to violently lashing tails, fly past, gushing noxious liquid from their severed waists. I sustain my fire as long as my hopper loads last. Leaping horrors pop, burst, fracture, explode in showers of viscous matter.
Open the door! Open the door!
Carl is screaming. The housekeeper has sunk to the ground in shock, the key falling from limp hands. I can just hear the housekeeper murmuring. What is that?
The Great Devourer! The Great Devourer!
The action is savage, unstinting. The more I hit and burst, the more of them there are, capering and bounding in. Their chattering mouths seem to be laughing at us. I'm out! Balak shrieks. Angharad leaps to defend him, decapitating two of the creatures and kicking another aside. The bodies are piling up.
Balak cowers behind her, trying to slam home a fresh clip. He's too slow. A scything limb catches Angharad across the forehead and knocks her down. A glancing blow, not enough to kill. But she's dead anyway. Unless. I keep the chair's cannons firing. I reach out and wear Angharad, snatching her up before she hits the ground. Eviscerex is a purring monster in my hands. It knows what it has to do. I let it drive into the enemy, remembering my blade schooling from dear, lost Arianod long ago, and allowing Angharad's training to leak from her unconscious mind to inform my movements. I cut them apart, monster after monster after leaping, pouncing monster. Balak has reloaded. He stands up, blasting into the endless wave. He kills every single thing charging at him, except one. A gouging hook tears into his thigh. He falls, passing out in pain shock. I wear him too, dragging him back into the fight, making him shoot again. His gun roars.
Carl, I need you.
Thonius has also reloaded. He fires his pistol point-blank into the wall of jabbing, black, chitinous snouts, and sees brain cases burst with each pump of his trigger. He has only a few shots left.
Carl!
Carl Thonius goes down. I see it happen. I see his frail body, limbs cartwheeling, carried over by the pouring wave of creatures. I try to reach out, but I can't wear him too. I'm stretched too far with Balak, Angharad, and my own chair. The chair is still valiantly pumping cannon shots into the endless legion of monsters. They land on me, clawing and clacking. They push me back, despite the holes I blast in them. The chittering monsters explode and topple away, but there are always more pouring in behind. They weigh me down. They overturn me. This is the end. Their abominable hooks screech and tear at my chair. Internal system alarms sound as they puncture my armor. Too many. Way too many. This is the end. Gregor, I'm so sorry. I... The world, red already, goes blood red. I am blinded by blood. I feel their blades dig into me. I try one last time to... Red. 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 A flare of insulted rage. Lucius Vorner looked up at the door sharply.
What the hell?
He muttered. The door was rocking in its frame, pounding. Red light, like the issue of a dying sun, seeped through the gaps between the door and its frame, and shafted into the witch house.
Something's coming back, Nail said.
As Vorner looked back around at him, Nail flicked the smouldering butt of his low stick into Vorner's left eye. Vorner snarled in pain and recoiled, clutching his face. Nail lunged forward with the blade Vorner had given him, but there was suddenly no time to finish the job. No time at all. Up on the highest platform, the door shuddered. It flexed in its frame, the wood bulging, and blew open on its hinges. A huge, pressurized gout of scouring fire and boiling red energy vomited out of the doorway. The fire cloud was filthy and red. It seared out through the door's frame in a great, concussive belch that shook the platform and the room itself. Everyone in the theater chamber was knocked to the floor. All the candles and lamps around the edge of the platform flew off and smashed in the lower floor space. Spilled lamp oil ignited. The expanding fireball from the doorway rolled up into the dome overhead. Several electrical systems, overcooked, exploded in showers of sparks. Another belch of flame gusted out of the open door, as fierce as the first. The chamber shook again, fires caught, and began to blaze in the girded vault of the theater's dome. Something, a photolumen lamp perhaps, exploded with a volatile report and spat debris across the chamber. The witch house lurched, as if wounded or stung. It staggered. Those who had managed to get on their feet fell back down again. The chamber was lit amber by the spreading, cracking fires and the eerie red glow pouring through the open door. Nail struggled to rise, but Vorner was already standing. He grabbed Nail by the throat, lifted him off the walkway with one hand, and threw him like a doll. Nail hit the rail, tumbled over it, and disappeared down onto the lower deck where the lamp oil fires were raging. Vorner turned, gazing at the wide open door and the red sunlight streaming through it. More flames, weaker now, billowed out of the open doorway, followed by a shimmer of alien dust. Then silence.
On your frigging feet,
Vorner yelled at his men. He drew his chainsword, moving towards the steps that led up to the top platform. Dazed and bewildered, his men hurried to follow him, all except the two watching Kiss. The hooded housekeepers remained in a cowering huddle. Something quick and jerky moved, fleetingly, inside the red glare of the doorway. Two gleaming silhouettes leapt forwards together and hung for a moment, perching on the sides of the doorframe with their nimble, clawed feet, like birds. Then they bounced down onto the platform into view. Tails high and straight, they stepped forward slowly, their hook claws scraping the deck. The